Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Cyber Security Recruiter podcast. Today, I'm joined by Kevin Baker. How are you doing?
Good. How about you?
I'm good. Nice to see you again. For everyone listening, me and Kevin were just chatting before we hit record, and we're just going to keep it informative, educational, but relaxed. We're going to imagine Kevin was sat in the local pub in central London in the UK, me and you with a nice pint of beer, hey?
Hey, sounds great.
Cool.
I'm looking forward to the show. There's some really cool stories in here that involve security and career progression and celebrities that most of the listeners will know. I'm looking forward to it and some really cool stuff in here. But Kevin, for listeners that don't know who you are, I'm going to do you an intro. If I get anything wrong, feel free to correct me afterwards, but I'll try my best. But yeah, started off back in the day at Diebold. You were a team lead in the security operations. You progressed up to regional security officer and again progressed within that same company over a 12, 13 year period, all the way up to security manager of global services. You then moved on to Westfield Group as a information security leader. You were there for around 8.5 years. You were then a lead, a insurance shield and post-incident response program lead advisors. Then you were a CISO for PC Fortress Security Risk Management, and you are currently a CISO for Fortress SRM. So sound like a busy man. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, cool. Do you know what, Kevin, before we get into it, like the CISO job, it's a tough gig these days. You've got to be on point, haven't you?
Yeah, you do. And the CISO title is, you know, I always say for most CISOs, you're the chief of nothing and you're the officer of nothing. You know, it's a job that must fit the company that you're in. But the CISO title means you should be talking to the board, you should be talking to the executive committee, and you should be able to relate all those technical things that you used all your career to people who don't know all those acronyms and be able to talk in a way that makes sense to them. That's what makes a good CISO, a good communicator.
Yeah, definitely. Someone that can bridge that gap between the technical and the non-technical people. And sure, I think some organizations give you guys the credit you deserve, and I think others don't. I think I can tell, I notice in the hiring process, I can tell when I'm hiring for companies that have perhaps had a breach or had an incident or had something go wrong. They take that CISO hire a bit more seriously than the ones that
I bet they do.
Yeah, we can probably talk about that. We can do a whole episode on that, Kevin. But I've done you a bit of an intro. I don't ever think I can do it as well as you. So I'll start where I always start, which is, who are you? What do you get up to in Kevin's world right now?
In the latter years of my career, I'm almost 71 years old. I love what I do. I want to keep doing it for a while more. I'm very excited to be where I'm at. But I backed into this industry almost 30 years ago at a time when there was no such thing as a CISO. And even cyber wasn't even a term yet. I was afforded a lot of opportunity that allowed me to grow and to learn in ways that would be very difficult to do now. I spent a lot of time in what I'm doing, talking to clients, working with clients, but also mentoring people, college students, even high school students, executives even, and just trying to bring the perspective that I've been able to gain to people who may have a more narrower view of what cybersecurity is.
Yeah, cool, Kevin. It's a real, like we touched upon a moment ago, I think that skill of being able to articulate risk and in a clear and concise manner, but I think it's such an underrated skill and not talked about as much. And I know if people can master that skill, it's incredibly valuable. The salaries go with it. The career progression comes with it. Have you got any tips for how you've got that skill set down or how you've refined that skill set over the years for people that are struggling with it?
Certainly, there are people who communicate well and connect people. And then there's good technical people. A good CISO is going to be somebody who's made that journey. Maybe started out far more technical. I don't think that you can effectively come out of the university and be a CISO. You need to get out there in that school hard knocks and find out what it's really like to deal with the technical people and then go to the executive suite and tell them what's going on. I remember early instances there at Diebold where that one vice president, he was a great guy. I loved it. Huge guy with him in your hand just kind of disappeared. And yes, he trained for Navy in college. And he told him something and I knew what was going to come out. He would say, "All right, now tell me why I care." And I think that taught me a whole lot about that, that that's really all he cares about. All the tech lumber jumper doesn't mean a whole lot until he understands why he should care about what I'm telling him. And that was my tip. Tell people what they need to know that's relevant to their job, not just something that justifies your technical acumen, but something that really makes sense to the business. The phrase is, you got to use business language. That's very nebulous. Mm-hmm. What people care about is what you want to address.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so let's say rather than talking about cross-site scripting or SQLI, actually talk about the business impact, or if you're talking to C-suite, probably talk about how much it might cost them or how many days offline they might have or something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Cool. We touched upon it a bit, but I do want to talk about your entrance in, because it was unorthodox. I know it ties in with why you help people and do a lot of work in the space. So how did you break in, mate? Talk me through it.
I went into the workforce out of high school from a blue-collar family. My father was a rubber worker. I grew up south of Akron, which was the rubber capital of the world at that time. Every major tire manufacturer was there in Akron. And boom and Bowman. By 1973, I graduated from high school in 72. By 73, 74, there was an oil crisis. There was a market crash because of that oil crisis. That affects, of course, oil immediately affects the rubber industry. And right when I entered the job market, Firestone, Goodyear, Goodrich, they put thousands of men on the street. There were no jobs. Literally, they came out of high school. There was nothing to get. I literally took a job as a sanitation worker. We called them garbage men back then. And I was the guy at the rear step for about a year. And I figured out how to get into the cab of the truck and be the driver. I learned how to drive the truck. And after about 18 months, then I went to a construction company where I drove their carryalls hauling heavy equipment. Next thing you know, I'm in the heavy equipment. I'm thinking, I'll work outside my whole life. This is awesome. You know, by the end of May, I had a tan. My hair was on my shoulders. I worked in shorts and work boots. And I thought, this is great. And I got hurt. I did that about 8 years. I got hurt. I had to take a job in a factory because anything in a factory was going to be easier than what I was doing. And as it turns out, the three foremen that my father had, by this time he had retired, they were in this polymer plant. They recognized me as his son. They said, we want you to work in the lab. We want you to come and work in the lab. So I went in the lab. And I found out I was really good with technical things, even though I had never wanted to go to college. It was never my ambition to go to college. So I didn't explore things like that. But I found out I was really good at technical stuff. I learned technical writing there by converting ASTM, American Standard Test Methods, into work instructions. And I did that for 13 years. And during that time, that was the PC craze. That was when people started having computers in their homes. So I bought one for my son, who I think was six. And of course, he needed a game. So I bought him a game, X-Wing. It didn't run right. Now I'm reading the box. But it doesn't run like that. Next thing I knew, I tore the computer apart. You know? And my wife came home. The computer's all over the thing. She's like, oh my God. I got it back together. That led me into building PCs first. And this was back in the Windows 3.1 days. This was way back there. I started getting pretty good at building up, overclocking the processors, building high-performance gaming machines. A friend of mine said, hey, I've got this little side gig that I'm doing that for Right Wheel Law, which was a natural law firm. Something I'll tell you about natural law firms. No lawyers work there.
Okay.
So he said, I'm building a network. And by this time, I had learned how to do some internet stuff. I was pretty good with OpenBSD, which is very lightweight Unix-based operating system. And I could build firewalls. I understood we got to protect this company from the internet. So I did the networking piece. I built the network, built him a firewall, a proxy server, and we got paid for that. I thought, hey, that's great. Nice side gig. When we were cleaning up and doing the last few things, the director of the Right Way Lyle came in and waved us into the conference room. And I hear this voice and I immediately recognize it. It was Wesley Snipes. And Wesley Snipes had paid for this work to be done. It was about, I don't know, $3,000. And he was the one who paid for that. Now, if you remember, he got a little trouble with the federal government over his taxes. And one of the ways that he was doing was like working with these natural law firms. And obviously they were not giving him the exact counsel that he needed, but I was blown away that, hey, I just got a paycheck from Wesley Snipes. So I leaned into what I was doing there, that little piece of business that we did. And the fellow I worked with, actually, we were in a band together. And he said, we could really use you at Diebold, somebody with your skills. And that ended up in me getting an interview. And I went to work in, and I got to say, it was a shadow IT group that was trying to develop services, managed services. Now, remember, ATM manufacturer, what were they good at? Bending steel, making heavy boxes. It was originally a Diebold Soft Safe and Lock company. But their concept of doing managed services over the wire, this was very new. So this group that I hired into, that's what we did. And my job was to do the hardware, but they didn't have a budget. So I'd had to go into the retired assets trailer and get whatever I could find, you know. So I made these Frankenstein servers for our development laboratory, but eventually those Frankenstein servers turned into the first Linux box on the Diebold network. And I remember my boss said, I want you to learn how to run this operating system. And it was Linux. And this web server, it was Apache. I remember it was Apache version 2. That's how long ago this was. So that ended up being the services electronic reporting access system, which is still running today. Now, not the same software and hardware that I did, but the concept was the same. So during the time that I did that early forays into security, is we got the Morris worm. Now, the Morris worm was old even by then. It was the first piece of software that could crawl. Mm. I could move around the internet. Mm. Another of my servers got it, two Linux servers, and I had to combat that. And to me, it was like, this is like a detective story. How did this happen? How do I fix it? How do I keep it from ever happening again? And I think right then I got the bug. It was defending the castle. I ultimately went on to help people at corporate, you know, that they saw they had no security team. And they saw that I had some skills, and particularly in a mail server. And they were running 26 Exchange servers. There were like 60, 65 companies. 26 Exchange server, and they're just dying. You know, they're just so much mail from. And most of it was just spam. And so they said, can you build us a spam filter? And I said, let me see what I can do. So I pull up PostFix, I add a spam assassin to it, and I build them a spam filter. Very manual. Not like the AI-driven things that we use for security today. It was very manual. And they went from 26 Exchange servers down to 16. So they see that cost savings. That's how they saw it. At the same time, they had a guy from Capgemini come in and do a security assessment of their company. He said, yeah, you're leaking net BIOS to the internet. You're not in good shape. Right about that time, there was a reduction in force. Market wasn't good, reduction in force. And I came into work one day and my boss called me into his office and said, really, look, I want you to know that has nothing to do with your job performance. That doesn't sound good. You're eliminating your position. So we went down, did the thing with HR. And the guy says, well, here's the deal. We'll give you this package. You sign here. We'll give you this package. You could take this to a lawyer, make sure that's good. I mean, they were looking out for me. Mm. And I said, no, I think that I'll just sign. And this was a defining moment for me. I said, look, this is the best job I've ever had. I hate to lose it. These are the best people I've ever worked with and the most exciting work I've ever done. So I'm just thankful for every moment that I've had here, and I'll sign it. And if this is where we part ways, then thank you very much for this. And by that time, it was about 5 years, and his jaw dropped. And I'd never seen that actually happen where somebody actually just went, that's what he did. But I didn't know. There was about four or five other people, and they cussed him out. They just threw a fit. So I went back up, packing my stuff up, getting everything, putting it in a box. I got to the last box, and I have this picture of my wife. They call them glamour shots in those days where they fix it.
Yeah.
I always got that picture where I could see it. I'm picking that up and I'm thinking, I'm going to have to go home and tell my wife I just lost my job. And right when I did that, this HR guy taps me on the shoulder and he says, step back into the office with me. So I step back in there. He hits the speakerphone and he says, Scott, are you there? And this voice goes, yeah, I'm here. And he goes, do you have the signature? And he goes, yes, in my hand. And the HR guy turns back to me and he goes, tear up all that paperwork you just signed. No break in your service. You're going to go to work at corporate headquarters. It was a position which was literally the very first person in their security team, other than this contractor. And so I got a promotion and actually I got a raise at the top. That job where I went, where I used OpenBiz deed to use retired assets out of that thing, which I learned with the other group, we threw firewalls all around the globe. I set like 45 of these OpenBSD firewalls on little HP Vectra laptops that were in the retired assets trailer. So with no budget, we threw a perimeter around a global organization. Of course, by the time we got number 40, 41, 42, the hard drive started dying. So we switched to a Cisco ASAs were brand new. And I worked with people all over the world fielding these firewalls. Ultimately, I became security manager for global services, which was now a pretty well-developed thing. And I traveled to 16 countries.
Cool.
Adjustments and would travel sometimes with the Tiger team, IT, business development, sales, IT directors of that area, and then me for security. So I worked with so many different cultures and all over Europe, South America, Asia. And I think that taught me part of my communication skills, because we were not just talking to different positions within the company. We were talking to people in other cultures. I had to learn how to respect someone in Thailand or how to respect someone in Warsaw or in Colombia or in Brazil, and saw so many different ways that people were trying to secure their company that were, it was, I used to say, this is a real screen door on the submarine. It's not something that's not going to stop. So I learned a lot that way, and I got a lot of opportunity. And that, again, as you alluded to when we started the segment, is that I think that's why I'm so keen to help people to add some experience to them when they come out of that university and they've got a degree, but they don't know a fraction of what they need to know. They know a bunch of technical stuff. So this opportunity to tell them with stories, here's how I communicated this to that person. Here's how I communicated this to that person. It is my way of giving back to an industry that's been very good to me.
Yeah, no, thanks, Kevin. And just one thing you said there, like one common theme that you've mentioned through all that is the word and the action learning. Like you were even, I know we joke a bit about, you know, you come a long way since from garbage man to CISO. A lot's happened there. But even when you were in that garbage industry or job, you were actually had a huge appetite for learning even then. And I actually was watching, there's a famous social, he's an American guy. He's from, he lives in Baltimore. His name's Alex Hormozy. And he was talking about how doesn't matter where you start in life. Doesn't matter if you start rich or poor or start up here or down here. If you've got this insatiable appetite to learn and better yourself and gain knowledge, in the end, you will win. You've proven that. You've literally been a dustbin man or a garbage man, and you're now seasoned. I put that down to not luck, not anything, just that appetite to learn and better yourself all the time. And you've done that consistently for a long period of time, and look where it's got you.
Yeah, to all over the world, really. And during that time, during those years, by the time I was traveling the world, I had 5 security certifications. So I was constantly learning. At first CISSP, then Certified Information Systems Auditor, then once having to do with other industry things, PCI stuff. And then I was grandfathered into the ISACA C-RISC, you know, Certified in Information Security, Risk and Information Security Controls. So lots of certifications, and each one of those, you know, you're talking about 500 hours worth of work in each one of those. So that was my college. My college was on the job training. And then since then, I probably sponsored 25 people as a CISSP. So always working with people, encouraging, them. Then you had to jump right up to a CISSP. Now there's easier ones you can get stepping stones to do that. And I've helped a lot of interns. It's hard to have interns as a consultant now, but back when I was at Westfield, always had several interns, and I'm very proud to say they have all gone on to become just killer security people.
Oh, good. Do you know what? When we were going to talk about your way in, breaking in, because it's so unorthodox, I was thinking perhaps it wouldn't relate to much now, but I think it does because you came in a tough market. It sounds like at that period of time, there was significant layoffs going on, not too dissimilar from what's happening in certain areas of the tech market or the security market, even this week or even right now. So there's a lot of relatable stuff there. But yeah, I just love that real desire to learn. You talked about building a firewall, a proxy server. Like, I don't think you were, correct me if I'm wrong, Kevin, but you weren't even really thinking about getting a raise or getting a, but you were just loving it and just loving learning from what I can.
And there was always a problem. There was always a problem that I was trying to overcome. And my resources, if I got a computer science degree in 1975, I would have been using punch cards. And it had no relevance to what happened all of a sudden. In the ATM industry, when I started, they were all running OS 2 Mark 4. That was the operating system.
Yeah.
And it was dial-up, not TCP. When that changed, and everything that could go wrong went wrong. So there was always a problem going on somewhere in the world because Windows was not secure. And it was very difficult to make it secure. There was always a problem. My objective was, okay, how do I overcome that? And my reference was the internet. And I was using a browser called AltaVista, which only the gray hairs remember. AltaVista, and I'm surging. I remember to build that first Ceres machine, I had to we were using Oracle for the database and Oracle for memory. Oracle says, how much memory do you have? Okay, I'll take that. And so I had to learn how to compile a kernel with everything stripped out of it, except what I needed. And I remember searching and I find this guy, this is no joke, in Croatia on the internet, based on a search that I did in AltaVista that says, oh yes, when you're compiling the kernel, the Shmax configuration Bible needs to be set at this. And I set it that, and that's the first time the thing would compile properly. So I thought, the internet is my brain. So what's in my brain? Whatever is in the internet. That's the way I tackled the problems. And my first, now people will say, Google is your friend. And what they're telling you is go away and answer your own questions. I was doing it back then. And I guess today that's still the same way. I look for help. I don't think I'm the smartest person in the world, but I've met an awful lot of smart people. And I'm quick to reach out to them, ask questions, learn what I can. And now the state that I'm in my career, it's okay. I don't know how much more I can cram into this brain, but I sure know a lot of people. So now my network is global. I've got friends in every one of those countries, great technical people. I've met so many people. One of them I met doing an incident response in Shanghai, China. They had a website. Diebold had a website. There's just a brochure. Here's this is what we look like. But without corporate knowing on the back end, they were actually running transactional things and they were doing service. This is how they sent their service people all over the nation of China, was through this website. And it was defaced. By this time, there was a CISO at Diebold. There was a functioning security team. I was part of that. I was a manager on that security team. And I was... My boss came over and he goes, you got a passport, right? I said, yeah, I got a passport. He goes, good. You're leaving for China in 2 days. Great. So we took off for Shanghai. And he goes, I'm sending this young contractor with you. Just got out of the Marines a couple of years ago. His name was David Kennedy. And now a lot of people will recognize that name. He's on MSNBC, the Katie Couric show. He's all over the place. He was just a young contractor and but technical strengths like you wouldn't believe. And we flew to Shanghai and I could hear him over there. And I said, what are you? And I'm looking over, we're in one of those little pods. What are you doing over there? And he goes, I'm writing I learned this new program, this language called Python, and I'm writing something. I'm going to call it the social engineering toolkit. That's still something that hackers use all the time, and who knows what version it is. But the first version of it was written on a plane on the way to Shanghai. We got to Shanghai, and I watched this guy. I did the air cover, and I dealt with the executives and with the other managers, and he figured out that the defacement of the website was actually done by a bunch of hackers who were criticizing them because they had not secured their website. Someone else had hacked their website, and they were running a business out of this website. And he's looking at early versions. It's all in Chinese. He's looking at Babel, and then he's translating it, figured it all out. We secured that website, and we flew home after. I think we were there about 10 days. And he eventually came onto the team at Devo, and then I left after a couple of years. He became the chief security officer at Devo. And then when he left there, he started a company called Trusted Sec. Later on, now he started another one called Binary Defense, and they're more the technical SIM and actually just one of our partners. What we don't do, they do. What they don't do, we do, and we partner. So here's a relationship of an incredible technical resource that I've learned so much from through the years. That after, what has it been, about 22 years since we had that experience together. Unfortunately, for that website, we wouldn't give them the administrative credentials at first, but they kept, we need it. And so eventually they were given, the people in country were given their credentials back. 3 weeks later, they were hacked again. And the reason why was they wanted to run an FTP server. And so they got one. They didn't want to pay for it. So they got a crack file. And all crack files, license breakers, it got malware. So we had to fly all the way back there. And of course, the corporate wanted to make it hurt. So we booked the flights and left within 24 hours. I think the flights were $16,000. And that was charged to that region. So it was a hard lesson for them. But for the lack of $30.
Yeah. I hope you got to drink lots of nice wine and eat lots of nice food on that $16,000 flight.
Oh, yeah. Like I said, we were in a pod, first class.
Kevin, when I'm listening to you speak, there's so many things that I can relate back to learning. Like you talked about compiling that kernel and like almost like doing everything manually. And I'm noticing certain things on our team within our recruitment agency where that's missing. And I'm hearing it from my clients as well. And I'll explain what I mean is you manually had to strip a process back and look at something because that's what you have to do then to get the end results. And I think that really helps your learning. And I just worry like with AI and stuff like that some of this stuff gets missed. And it's a lot of these tools that do stuff. They're great and they're great time servers. But if you don't understand what the tool's doing, you kind of hold your career progression back. So it's interesting to, again, here you're not focusing on the end result. You're not focusing on a raise or trying to earn more money. You're just obsessed and totally in love with every single aspect of the process, whether it's compiling a kernel, whether it's building a firewall on a proxy server, whether it's learning a new aspect of the job when you're on that garbage van, whatever it is, you're just obsessed with the process and obsessed with learning. And you've done that again and again for a sustained period of time. And that's what's got you to where you are. And I think it's just really nice for the listeners to hear that, whether someone's breaking in or whether someone's a mid-level security engineer or even if someone's senior trying to step up, just not losing. Sometimes we get so wrapped up in a raise or the end result and we forget about all this stuff you're talking about. So it's really nice to hear you breaking down your journey in such a granular way because there's a lot that can be learned from it, whatever level you're at now.
Absolutely. And I'm not as technical as I used to be. You progress through your career at a certain point, you're going to make a decision at some point. Do I want to stay technical? This is what would face you back in the 90s. Do I want to stay technical or do I want to make more money? In which case I've got to go into management. Now that's not so much the case, but it certainly was that. And so what we, many times what happens, you take really good technical people and you turn them into really bad managers, right? But I had this experience of having to deal with all these people. So I had to grasp the management pieces. I had to grasp the working with the human component, both from an attacker perspective and from the people that I'm working with. I was introduced to heavy compliance stuff because of the position that Diebold was in. They ended up having a full FFIEC examination council audit, where you've got the state, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, the Office of Threat Supervision, the FDIC, which is the insurance company for the American currency. And we had to present what we were doing. And I had to learn just the legality of it, the regulatory part of it. And that pulled me away from the technical pieces. During that time, I had people working for me and reporting to me then. And they would laugh. They would say, yeah, Baker, he's floated up into the administrative and he's not technically very astute anymore. But I never forgot what it was like to be one. I made the decision, okay, I'll do management if I have to stay there. I understand what these people are saying. I can communicate it to the people on the other side of me. And that's the way I looked at it. But if you're not elbow deep in that stuff, you can't keep up, especially today. Things change so fast, right?
Yeah, you're right, Kevin. I think in any aspect of security, I think especially like I see it with offensive security guys, you come off the tools for even a few months and it just moves so quick.
In the set of tools that we have now, you mentioned AI. Every tool, every platform that we use now has AI working with it in some way. And that tends to make you very disconnected from the underlying technology. Many security people now, they don't even understand TCP/IP. They couldn't decode packets to save their soul, right?
Yeah.
So we've got a new generation of workers that are still doing, I don't mean this in any critical way, but they are not curious about the underlying technologies, which that was what drove me. An insatiable curiosity. How does that work? How do you do that? We become disconnected from that. And I think the very best CISOs will be ones who spent at least part of their career as an administrator or a network administrator or as a developer, somebody they were hands-on, they worked with the technology, but they made the transition to other positions and not forgetting the technical underpinnings of what we do. And when AI comes on, it's just an easier way to do what you used to do. Now I'm talked to, I've got a platform, I just talk to it. Tell me this, and it tells me that. And that's the beauty of it. But if you're blinded by that, or if you're disconnected from that technology, you might be swinging the gates wide open for the hordes to come in rather than doing what you think you're doing. I'm all about business enablement. That's what we need to do. We need to enable the business by making it secure. I don't want you to be able to do it on the sidewalk out in front of the building and it be secure, not have to be, back in some data center. Let's get that out where we can earn money doing it. Making that tradition requires that you understand there are technical consequences for everything that you do. Every little configuration item has got a myriad of things that it's going to do or not do based on how you configure it. It's why cloud environments are so whacked these days. They just, out of the box, Microsoft said it, do it this way. So that they do it and they never investigate it. Microsoft does, they do the best they can. But the car salesman doesn't drive your car for you. And Microsoft is not going to drive your application for you. So you've got to learn how to drive. You have to understand it works. You might have to change a flat tire. So I think it's important if you want to be a good security person to stay connected either through continuing to do a little bit of technical things or staying very connected to your technical people and having them educate you. I'm not interested in telling my staff things. I'm interested in them telling me stuff. And I learn from them every day. And that'll keep you young.
Yeah, good. I think that you used that word curiosity, Kevin, about 5-10 minutes ago. And so right, because using the real life example, AI is great when it's great, but it's not always great. Sometimes it's terrible. You can relate it to the recruitment world. Like when I first started, Kevin, you'd get like your resume and you'd look at every company you'd ever worked at. And that would be how you did lead gen and lead generation and find other companies to recruit for. Whereas now we have AI tools that can just scrape the whole of LinkedIn, the whole of the internet, and they can produce lists of leads of companies for us to recruit from in seconds. But if that tool gets it wrong, which it does sometimes, and you don't know how to look for a good company manually, you can go off, and we've had it in our agency. We've had people go off on a tangent and hit up the wrong company. And again, it's like you're hacking. If you're getting tools to do different things and you don't understand what the tool's doing, you've got no way of checking it. So I think, I think it's whatever level you're at, stay curious. Don't try and take any shortcut. This tool could save me like a day a week or 2 days a week, but how's it doing it? And I think to remember that and keep your feet on the ground in relation to that is advantageous, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely is. And I had the opportunity to build some really fantastic security programs. And the work that I did at Westfield is still going on. Now, without a breach, there was no breach through the pandemic of ransomware, right? No breach. The next guy that came in after me, who was someone who I mentored, who is now the CISO for the state of Wisconsin, he took over for me. He took it to the next level. And then when he left and went to Wisconsin, the guy that ran it, he took it to the next level. Just a tremendous sense of pride on that citadel of security over there for a 175-year-old insurance company. They did policies before the Civil War. They've been around a long time. And my experiences there, I went from being fascinated and curious with technical systems to adding this system of human beings who are managing this company that's been around. There were more people there that had never worked anywhere else in their life but Westfield. Okay, wow. 50 years, and they were retired with 50 years. It was like their biggest risk was reputation. Nothing could harm that reputation. And so I was challenged to build a program there from 5 repurposed IT people, no comprehensive formality to the program, no real position. I was called the information security leader, no concept of a CISO, reported inside IT with 5 people, no security certifications. When I left after 8.5-9 years, there were 17 people. We had over 40 security certifications. We had a full complement of policies, procedures, work instructions. We were doing security awareness training at a very high level. And it's because the management embraced it. They weren't easy to convince, but they did embrace it. And I learned, how do I talk to these people? How do I go from walking around with my hat in my hand, trying to convince people that there's a problem, to getting them to conceive, if you don't do this, then this could likely happen. Luckily, it was an insurance. They understood risk. They listened to me, and they enabled. So I realized from then on, and now in my consulting practice with the hundreds now of companies that I've worked for, I realize if you don't convince the executives, you're wasting your time on the managers and the technology department. Because they will never be empowered to do what the company needs to do. So getting executives to realize the risk and just make good business decisions based on risk to empower those people below. I began to see myself as a resource for the technical people. Not as a boss, but as a resource to the technical people. How do I empower you? How do I get budget for you? How do I get respect for you? Part of it entailed, okay, you can't act like that. You're going to have to come out of the dark room and talk to people. And then for the executives to be able to translate what these good technical people were doing. So now the system that I see encompasses technology. It encompasses people. And then, of course, all the process linkages between those three things.
Yes. Yeah, thanks. I really like what you just said. You've got to come out the dark room and talk to people. And I was just about to say, I bet you've had to have a lot of awkward conversations over the years, and they're so easy to avoid. Yeah. And it's so easy to talk to the fellow security engineer next to you and moan or complain about how nothing's getting fixed, or you're like finding the same vulnerabilities that you found last year. And that's a really easy conversation to have and complain. But the hard one to have is, like you said, making sure you go into the correct decision maker or the right member of the C-suite. and have that awkward conversation. It's, yeah. I don't know, how do you do that? Or did you just force yourself to have it? Or?
Lots of failure through all these years, lots of failures, lots of doing it wrong, lots of not using the right words. But ultimately, what I learned is never burn bridges, try and speak to people's expectations where those expectations are before you try and change their expectations. I've learned the hard way that what doesn't work is me trying to get those executives to think the way that I do. They're the ones that are making all the money. I don't want them to think like me. I want them to think like them, but with an enhanced perception of what security is and what they and how they need to make their business decisions. I think where a lot of CISOs fail is they go in, they try and blind them with science. That doesn't work. They try and use the gotchas. They use, I believe, never waste good pain, but you can do it right or you can do it wrong. Gotchas will never get you ahead. But to get them thinking about their own job and their own decision-making process, but doing it with an awareness of what the risk is. And sometimes I wouldn't agree with them, but back 100%, even if they're wrong, and do the best that I could for them. As soon as cybersecurity becomes combative, you lose. So you can't be a naysayer, but you also have to be honest. If the baby is ugly, you've got to find that way to describe their situation without insulting them. And a lot of guys fail to do that. They just want to bluster their way through. And that just doesn't work. I think probably the most important ingredient to getting ahead in cybersecurity is humility. You must be humble, must be thankful. And I learned that back there at Diebold. Thank you for this job. Thank you for these great people that I've worked with. If you want something good to happen, you've got to keep the right internal attitude of humility, that you're not the be all end all. And there's probably somebody smarter than you in the room, but just a humble take on presenting the facts as they are without embellishment. You'll get your chance on the soapbox, but I've always waited until the time was right. And I think that dealing with the perceptions and the personalities through navigating management, that those were the things that ultimately built the security program.
Yeah.
So these things are not anti-security, they are pro-security. I think with such pride over what we have here at Fortress, what I was able to build it, and back at Westfield, I'm proud of the organizational structures that I built that allowed people to talk about risk in a way that was productive. And that doesn't happen on a keyboard. It happens that when you're across the table with somebody. Yeah. And I've had to deal with difficult people, and I'm sure there are people out there who thought that I was difficult.
And they better not do, mate. But you know what? You used the word humility. I was going to mention it earlier, actually, but you mentioned it again. You said about not being the thinking you're the smartest person in the room. And you said earlier, you went, oh, I'm not the smartest guy, but I cram as much into my brain as possible. But just you saying that, if you've had the mentality of not thinking you're the smartest guy, but you just want to learn from everyone, I'd argue you probably are by now. If you've had that attitude for years and years, and you've crammed as much information in as possible, and you maintain that humility, it makes your communication skills, your interpersonal skills better, your ability to connect, to build rapport, and it's just nicer anyway. It's just that there is so many benefits to it. And also something else you said about not burning any bridges, and especially in security, because this community, as you'll know better than anyone, Kevin, it is just so small. Like, I've done a post today on LinkedIn about a podcast I recorded a while ago, and someone's commented on it going, oh yeah, I worked with Dave years ago. He's in that. And it's everyone knows everyone. It's just, you don't ever want to be the arrogant or kind of Mr. or Mrs. No, it's just never going to go down, is it?
Yeah, no, it isn't. And if we have time for one more story, I would like to share
what
I feel like is one of my crowning moments. It's like a mountaintop experience for me. I got the privilege of working with Jim Yeager, who was one of the founders at Arete. Formerly ran security operations for the NSA, Air Force General. He was a luminary to me, and I got the chance to work for him and with him. He had a customer in Africa, largest bank in Africa. And he said, Kevin, they need these some assessments done, and then we'll go and present to their board of directors. So I did. another partner, Sean Newman, good partner, ex Army Special Forces, tremendous talent, just like David. We did three projects. We looked at their work from home. This was during COVID. Their work from home strategy, their overall technical strategy. And we did this examination for about 3 months. And then we were going over to present our results. And Jim was going to do an overview, catch up on the industry. So we go over there, we go to Johannesburg, and we go into the boardroom of this banks in 23 countries around Africa. Just the most incredible facility. The table was like an African war canoe. That was the table we were sitting at. Everybody had their own microphone, their own monitor, which is down below. And here's all of these people. And they were actually all chairmen of the board somewhere.
Okay.
So there's 25 people in the room and a bunch of people online and screens around the table. And Jim did his update, and he was, of course, fantastic, as he always is. And I thought, oh, man, I got to follow that. I had to just do the results of our examinations. And then I did a forward view. And then it was all over. And the chairman of that board comes walking down, shakes my hand, and he said, "You made him laugh four times. I'd never heard him laugh before. When you come next time, will you bring your wife?" And I thought,
yes.
I did it. You know, I don't think I ever felt more fulfilled than I did in that moment, because it was a synthesis of technical analysis, of prognostication about the future and what I thought their threats would be in the next 5 years. And of the three threats, two of them have come to pass. So I managed to be right there, synthesized all of that, communicated it to obviously a very difficult group of people, and had them, I unarmed them, and they received my message, and it was acknowledged. That it does not get better than that.
Yeah, man. Thanks, Kevin. I've heard that before, that ability to make, and it really is an ability. If you can make people laugh by getting some meaningful information across and reading the room correctly, like it sounds like it does. Again, it's such a skill. I've actually heard in like sales and stuff like that.
That made the message stick.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's really not what people hear you say in that room. It's what they remember when they leave. Those are the things that have to stick. You know, and if you can give them some perspective that helps them think the way they need to think, unless you work for a security company, security is not making the money. It's not generating the revenue. And I've enjoyed consulting, still do every day. But when you're the practitioner and you're protecting the castle, you want them to make money. You want that business to succeed, and you are guarding that business. I think it's a wonderful motivator. It awakens within people to be defenders. You know, that we don't want to be aggressors in the world. We want to be defenders. Sometimes you have to get pretty aggressive to defend, but I've always said we are crime fighters,
yeah,
but we're not the police. We work with the FBI all the time and CISA, and that's a great thing. But to take the position that you have, you're a defender. And what you're defending people from is crime and hatefulness. And there's a great satisfaction in knowing that you're part of making the world better. You're making it safer. I don't have a great appreciation for the over-the-top radical statements that people make. I'd rather be that little bit quieter defender that makes businesses more capable, that makes businesses more profitable, and that provides a place where people can work and have a good life. And that, you know, it used to be protecting people in physical means. Now it's digital means. More lives are ruined by digital mishaps than are ruined by physical mishaps. And all you have to do is talk with one grandma who lost all of her grandkids' pictures to somebody who ransomed her for $200, and then the key didn't work. When you see that heartbreaker, that is a person who was injured by terrible people who just want to take and take, you know. That's a great sense of satisfaction.
Yeah,
for me.
Yeah, no, it's good. It's been really good. It's been a bit of a masterclass on like communication and how to do it. And I think, again, I think it's needed. And I've been wanting to take the podcast more in this direction because I feel like there's all these technical resources online, like this, the technical element, people can go to lots of different places to learn that. But this communication piece and this ability to articulate risk in a clear, concise manner, to get budget sign off, it's all stuff that's, I think, needs to be talked about more, and we're covering it really nicely. Kevin, I wanted to ask you one question on about when you're teaching people and they're learning, is there anything you see above and beyond what we've talked about that enable learning or optimize learning? Or is there anything like really good learners do that not so good learners don't do? Is there any hints there?
I think one of the, I'll make some observations on people as I've seen them develop through the years, because I've had them from high school students, and now they are into industry. So I've known them for a long time. The ones who could reach out and broadly learn a lot of things and didn't dive too much down into one area, they tend to be the better communicators. Okay. There are some people who only want to be technical, and they're going to work in that dark room, and they're happy. They're not people. They're happy there, but they have to understand they need to be connected with the team so that the stack continues. So I think if you're desiring to be a CISO or to be someone who runs a program and you're the head defender, that's what a CISO is to me. You're the head defender. If you want to be that person, you have to have a broad range of skills, not simply the technical skills, but and be willing to be uncomfortable and be willing to maybe not look your best all the time. You've got to take some chances. Risk is not always to be avoided. Some risk must be embraced and accepted. And that gets down to the very heart about what risk management is. If you want to make money, you're going to have to take some risks. There's no safe bets, but it's learning how to balance that and how to get that whole functioning thing, the team, the program, the business working in concert together. You're going to have to learn from a lot of other people, and you're never going to quit learning. You know, I think I've talked to people who came right out of the university and put their degree to work, and they learned in that first 5 years after university, they learned more than they could have ever imagined that they were going to learn. And what they learned only opened the door to more learning. The ones who come out thinking that degree gets them a job and they've already lost, right?
Yeah.
Degree doesn't get you the job. You get the job and you keep the job because of your intense curiosity, your self-starter. You need to be a self-starter. I had wonderful parents, a wonderful family, but there were no college degrees in my family. We were a blue collar family. So I was not inspired in any way to go to college, but they taught me how to work. What they bequeathed to me was the attitude that if you want it, you can go after it. You can do anything you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a kid in the 60s, a teenager in the 60s. So you can just imagine all the things that I went through. But to have that inner drive is absolutely the key.
Cool, Kevin. Listen, we definitely need to do a podcast about what went down in the 60s. You're real, Bert. I loved it.
Where's there, too, buddy?
Kevin, it's been really nice. And I think we've covered some of the stuff we planned to. And some great episode, by the way. We've just let it naturally flow. And over an hour's gone really quick. And yeah, mate, it's been really nice to see you. And
thank you for the opportunity. It's a great conversation. I love doing it and open to it anytime.
Yeah, no, good. Perhaps we will do it one day in a pub together. That would be really good fun.
Again, thank you very much and appreciate the invitation.
But thanks again. Really nice to see you. And thank you.
Thank you.